House State Affairs Committee will please come to order. We have a full calendar today. On our agenda today is HB 243. That's a criminal conviction overturn, gets the PFD. That's my bill. And I'll have my vice chair chair that bill, since it is my bill, and I prefer to have another colleague chaired in those cases. We also have SB 9 coming from the Senate, of course, that involves what's in the election pamphlet. And we have HB 217, and that's Alaska Spirit license plate, sponsored by our colleague, Representative Chris Tompkins. And if there's nothing else to come before the committee, let's take roll. She's had an excused absence. She'll be here, but she'll be late.
Okay. Representative Keller.
Here.
Representative Vasquez.
Here.
Representative Grunberg.
He called. He'll be late. He's excused until he gets here.
Okay. Representative Price Tompkins.
Here.
Representative Tallarico.
Here.
Representative Grunberg.
Didn't we call him? Mm-hmm.
He's on his
way.
He's
on
his
way. Okay. So
he's late. Okay, and Chair Lynn.
And I am here.
Thank you.
So with that, if there's nothing else to come before the committee at this time, we're going to be hearing now HB 243, and I'm turning the gavel over to my Vice Chair, Representative Keller.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. First bill up before us is CS for House Bill 243, and what we're going to do is ask the sponsor staff here to go through, and if you would give us some background on how we got to the CS, just to make it, because the CS should tell us about the changes that are there as part of the process, it doesn't any order. And then also in the, we ought to testify online. We have the Department of Law is listening in. We have Mary Ellen Beardsley and John Skidmore. And then let's see here. Also in Anchorage, we have the Office of Director of Public Advocacy. I'm sorry, Rick Allen, the director, is online. And then we also have the Alaska Innocence Project. Bill Oberle is online. And then I believe here in the room we have Jerry Burnett from, Department of Revenue, and he will be testifying. Bill Oberle has asked to testify, and Rick Allen has asked to testify. They're not; the rest of them are there for questions. So, and then Hillary Martin, also from Juneau, is available to answer questions on the drafting. So, with that, go ahead and identify yourself for the record and give us some information on the bill. Thank you.
Deneen Tuck, Representative Lynn's legislative aide. House Bill 243, the permanent fund dividend bill. A lot of people will mistake that this is a bill strictly for the Fairbanks Four, but it is not. It's for all Alaskans. The Fairbanks Four are the ones that brought it to light that there was nothing on the books in the statutes that corrected an injustice that had been done by convicting anybody who may have been innocent and later their felony conviction being overturned, dismissed, or vacated. Representative Lynn worked over the interim to get this bill together and try to get it so that all Alaskans, and to correct the oversight.
Okay, so that is there any more you want to say about what the bill actually does? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, what's the difference between this CS and the previous CS?
On the changes of the two CSs between version E and version G, which E was our original, we changed the title and removed anything that had to do with an individual who had been pardoned. We also removed the word pardoned because of innocence and wrongful conviction. The reason for those removals was because if you pardon somebody, then you're asking the governor to make a finding of innocence. We did not want to do that because the parties who were pardoned could possibly still have committed the crime, and those are not the ones that we were looking for. We were looking for ones that the courts had overturned, dismissed, vacated, or reversed their cases. The next change is in line one. We removed the pardoned out of line 14, page 1. Out of page 2, line 4, we removed pardoned under I-2 of this section. And then going on to page 2, lines 5 through 7, we had originally put in language to allow interest for the permanent fund dividend to pay out in case anybody had applied under this rule or when anybody did. We removed that for the simple fact that we found out that in the permanent fund dividends history, no interest has ever been paid out. So an example that was given to me is if a child who is under the age of 18 and their parents do not apply for their permanent fund dividend, they would be allowed to apply once they turned 18 within 60 days. Even those types of Alaskans would not get any interest. So with that being said, we took it out because we did not think that would be fair. And then the next change was in page 2, lines 9 through 11. We were going to originally ask that the Department of Corrections make sure that anybody who had asked for a permanent fund dividend application would receive one. And through further research and discussion with the Department of Corrections, we found out how that is handled, so we removed that from the bill.
Okay, any questions of the sponsor or the sponsor staff from the committee? For the record, Representative Gruenberg has joined us, beat the traffic system, and is not here. So, any questions for the sponsor?
I almost went on the roundabout reverse.
Representative Gruenberg?
I almost went the other way.
No. Okay, so any questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't have a question. I say what you said is correct. On the pardon thing, you don't pardon somebody unless they were originally guilty. And this bill is not about people who are guilty. It's about people who are not guilty or are innocent. And as she said, this bill is not about the Fairbanks Four. We don't make bills to benefit one person or four people or any special individual. We make bills to affect everybody. And basically, the concept of the bill is when somebody makes a mistake, like the state, such as happened with the Fairbanks Four, it needs to be, everybody needs to be treated equitably. You can lose 1 year and not get the PFD. You can lose 18 years, as in the case of the Fairbanks Four. And I think there are others out there also who could fall under the parameters of this bill. And again, this bill is about being fair to anybody who's been put in jail and they've been innocent or vacated. And vacated means the thing never happened at all. I believe that's correct.
Yeah. We have two questions. One, Representative Vasquez, and then Representative Gruenberg. Representative Gruenberg, and then Representative Vasquez.
I just, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out one thing that we need to do before we move the bill out, and that is the title. The first part of the title, an act relating to the permanent fund dividend, unless we want it to be used for anything that somebody may think of. We really do need to narrow that down, or it will be caught at some point and used. And I'll make an appropriate motion, or somebody can figure out what you want to say. I'm looking at you, Ms. Tuck, to see what you think.
Representative Gruenberg, you're making a comment about the broadness of the title, that it can incorporate too broad of a range of amendments as it goes through the
you
process.
Bet.
Yes. Yeah.
Unless you want it to.
Yeah, no. And the sponsor, we, of course, would like to move his bill today. I'm hesitant. You know, I'm wanting us to get the questions on the table, and we'll make that determination as we go along. Representative Vasquez.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps simply deleting the words, the permanent fund dividend, comma, and relating to, So it would state, quote, "an act relating to a permanent fund dividend for individual whose conviction has been vacated, reversed, or dismissed." So it's a lot more specific that way.
Forgive me. Would you repeat that?
Okay. I would propose an amendment to delete the following words.
Oh, wait. The Representative Vasquez, what we're doing right now is just kind of feeling out, and no, not time for questions. We haven't even adopted the right CS yet.
Okay.
So if somebody would make a motion here to make adopt version G as the working document first, and then please explain what it is that you're concerned about.
So moved.
Okay, so we have before us as a working document version G, CS for HB.
You might want to wait until we see the final product.
And I'm sorry, Representative Vasquez, that I was distracted, but the change that you see necessary is?
Go ahead. I'll handle this for you.
Mr. Chairman, I've been asked to go to the Ethics Committee meeting hearing now, so can I quickly state my
please,
comments?
Please.
I just would recommend that we delete the words "an act relating to," delete the following words, "the permanent fund dividend and relating to," and then just have the title state "an act relating to a permanent fund dividend for an individual whose conviction has been vacated, reversed, or dismissed." So the topic permanent fund right away deals with these individuals. And I, by the way, I wholeheartedly support this bill. The two concerns I have been addressed. One was the interest rate, and two, the pardon provision that has been deleted, because there is no need to find innocence when a governor pardons an individual. So those two concerns. And I will be co-sponsoring this. I must excuse myself, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that's fine. You're excused.
Thank you.
Representative Grunberg?
I would suggest that's an excellent amendment. Why don't we wait and see what the final bill looks like in case something else changes? I'm happy if Representative Vasquez isn't here to make the motion.
Yeah, Representative Vasquez put that on the record, and I'm inclined to, again, to let this one soak a little bit. Let me ask the sponsor, myself, and or the sponsor staff.
No, I understand.
My first question when I saw the bill, you know, has been haunting me, is why do we need a law to get this done? You know, why isn't this handled in the court system already? I mean, to me, there's some pretty fundamental questions being raised about the ownership. At what point does the person own? And I think these things are untested in court, but I'm not sure. And I, you know, just wondered, did you think about that in the process? You know, whether or not, I mean, the people that are wronged, have they gone to court? Have they asked for relief? Or
I think somebody can, at least as far as the Fairbanks Four is concerned. I'm not concerned about any of the others trying to get the bill together, but. They were, of course, trying to get their sentence vacated. And so, you know, this is just part of that.
Okay.
And I'm surprised that the administration has not come forward to address this issue. But so far, they have not. And again, I go to the basic fairness here. And the issue needs to be addressed and resolved.
We'll take a brief at ease,
Mr. Chair.
We have test buyers later that can maybe respond to my question, unless the sponsor wants to go further. Is there any further questions for the sponsor or Representative Talrico?
I just have a question. Maybe we can address later about vacation and the potential. I guess I'll need an explanation from somebody legally if
that
judgment can be vacated, but there might be other charges involved.
As I understand it, vacation means
attorney.
Representative Lynn, did you have a comment?
I beg your pardon. To me, that means the thing never happened.
Okay.
It's as if nothing happened whatsoever. And any attorney can correct me on that if I'm wrong.
Representative Grunberg?
Thank you. I apologize for being a little late. I would suggest that these legal questions, we try, maybe Ms. Mead or somebody can answer them. Otherwise, we can get Hillary Martin from Ledge Legal. I think your questions are very important. I do have one question, if I could.
Representative Grunberg?
And I asked Ms. Tuck this question the other day, and I don't need an answer today, but I would like to have an answer, is how much this is going to cost the permanent fund?
At this time?
Identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry, Deneen Tuck. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. At this time, I do not have those. I will have to get that for you.
Mr. Chair, we can get it. I didn't want to put you on the spot. I just wanted to spread on the record. I did have
We're working on it.
Yeah.
Okay. So seeing no other questions at this time for the sponsor staff, thank you. And we're going to move to public testimony. And what I'm going to do is ask first, Mary Ellen, you're online, from, I believe, or John Skidmore and or. I was wondering, I know that you're there for answering questions. And there was probably a poorly asked question, but if you heard it, did you want to respond at this time?
Representative Keller, through the chair, I actually don't have a response as to why we need this law. I think it would be better for, I'm in the civil section, and I think probably a criminal attorney would probably be better able to answer those types of questions that you have regarding that, as well as the language of the bill itself.
Please identify yourself so we'll get that on the record.
I apologize. This is Mary Ellen Beardsley. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State of Alaska Department of Law.
And we got your point. Thank you. Good. Okay. So what we'll do is we'll be hearing from Hillary Martin. Maybe we can go there right now, because Hillary, do you have a comment on that? Or?
Yeah, this is Hillary Martin with Legislative Legal Services. And I'm sorry, the last bit of your question got swallowed as I picked up my phone. If you could just repeat it for me.
Thanks, Hillary. And that may be difficult because it was a poorly worded question, poorly thought out, off the cuff. But my thoughts were, when I saw the bill, is why do we need legislation to get this done? It just seems like when you're talking an issue of ownership, that should be something that should be clear enough here to sort out without going to new legislation. So if you would respond to that.
Yeah, Representative Keller, I believe the issue now is that the way that the statute is written for the permanent fund dividend, a person is just simply ineligible if they were incarcerated as a result of conviction of a felony, or they were sentenced as a result of a felony. And there's nothing, you know, you're ineligible for 1 year, and there's nothing that would let revenue look back and decide if the conviction was gone that they should get these back PFDs. And so you just need something in statute to allow that process to happen, because they were ineligible at the time the eligibility was set, and there's nothing currently in statute to change that.
Okay. I'll process that. Thank you. I would, and this is, I'm not an attorney. This is from a layman's perspective, but it seems like if that happened to me, I would be pretty indignant, you know, that it had been held back, if it was held back wrongfully. And it seems like there are some fundamental constitutional protections that would be in place, if we're talking an issue of ownership. And what I think I heard you say was that the ownership doesn't happen until or because of this law, because it's the act of being incarcerated that disqualifies. So I am just processing that. Thank you, Hillary. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You usually ask a very fundamental question that maybe we should, on this committee and judiciary, since we're both on the same committee, sort of routinely ask or have the bill sponsors be prepared to state on the record, why is the bill necessary? And I think that's an excellent question to start out with. And I'm commending it to the chair and the staff, and maybe on both committees. That's usually a pretty good question to ask to start with.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. If I had done my homework, I probably would have asked it a lot more intelligently of the sponsor before we got here. but it's on the record, and that's great.
It should be on the record. But
it is on the record.
What the reason is.
Thanks, yeah. Okay, so with that, we're going to go to Rick Allen, who's online to testify from the Office of Director of Director of Public Advocacy. Rick, are you there? If you are, identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Rick Allen, and I'm the director of the Alaska Office of Public Advocacy. Just very briefly, Office of Public Advocacy supports this proposed legislation. As many of you may know, Alaska is in a minority of states in the United States that don't have a compensation bill. That is a bill that would pay folks who, you know, have been determined to have been inappropriately incarcerated. You know, most states have a bill that would pay them X amount of money per year that they were incarcerated. And Alaska has no such bill. So it just seems to me that, you know, this is sort of the least we can do. When we have a situation where Alaskans have been incarcerated inappropriately, it seems to me the least we can do is give them back their dividends that they would have received had they not been in jail. And I think that, you know, from our perspective, this is a pretty straightforward, common sense piece of legislation. We're grateful to Representative Lynn for bringing this forward. And I would also, you know, completely agree with Hillary that I think the legislation is necessary because right now there is no vehicle to provide these people this relief, to give them their back dividends. I suppose they could sue in court to try to get it back, but I think this mechanism is much cleaner and easier, and I think this is a good way to go. So unless you have any questions for me, that's all the testimony I had this morning. Thank you.
Rick, if you would, this is Representative Keller. One thing, did you say most states? Do you know how many? And just again, if you would, put on the record what it is that other states have on their statute that we do not have when somebody is incarcerated inappropriately.
Yes, sir. You know, it's been a little while since I checked, but I believe the last time I checked it was 32 states out of 50 have a bill or have a law in the books that would that pays people a set rate per year for the time that they were wrongfully incarcerated. So, and that amount it varies from state to state. I believe the lowest that you'll see is around $40,000 per year, something like that. And then I think the highest is actually Texas, which I think pays $100,000 per year for every year that somebody was wrongfully incarcerated. I know Bill Overly is on the line to testify, and I would bet that he has those stats at his fingertips. He knows that stuff pretty well. But it's somewhere in that range, so it's about 32, 35 states, something like that, have such a statute, but Alaska is not among them.
Any questions for Rick Allen?
I may.
Representative Grunberg?
I'd just like to possibly come back to him. I want to hear what others
say. Are you going to stay online? Rick, Representative Grunberg has asked if he could come back to you a little later.
Yes, sir. No problem at all.
Okay, thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chair, this bill is very narrowly conceived to relate only to the PFD issue. Should they or should they not be allowed to apply for the PFD? That's what this is all about. There is another issue out there on compensation, but that's not this issue. We want to keep those very, very separate.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg?
Yeah, there's another bill that's passed, I think I passed out of this committee, and is in judish now.
Yeah.
And we need to take a look at that as well.
Okay. Bill Overly? Alaska Innocence Project, you have your testimony. If you would, identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Keller. I'm Bill Overly. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Innocence Project. We're a statewide 501c3 nonprofit whose mission is to identify and exonerate wrongfully convicted individuals in the state of Alaska, and we strongly support House Bill 243, and the reason is pretty simple. It's the right thing to do. If a person is convicted and that conviction is vacated and the charge is dismissed, it means the person was wrongly convicted, which means that their PFD was wrongly denied them during the period that they had that conviction and could not obtain their PFDs. So in correcting the wrongful conviction, the state and the people of the state of Alaska also would want to correct this wrongful denial of their PFD. I think it provides some assistance to people who get out of jail or out of prison after a wrongful conviction who have, in Alaska at this point, nothing else to help them when they get out. There aren't the services of someone who is correctly convicted and gets out and is helped by the parole and probation system. There is no compensation for the wrongly convicted, so this would provide them some ability to get back on their feet. And really the amount is a pittance compared to what the cost to the state is of wrongfully continuing to incarcerate an innocent person. I agree with Mr. Allen and the representative from the state who indicated the reason this bill is necessary is there is no mechanism to correct this injustice. We had checked when the Fairbanks Four had been exonerated to see if they could get their PFDs, and that there was no way they could do it under the current legislative process. So it's necessary to correct that in these cases. So I guess I will end where I started, and that is I urge passage of House Bill 243 because it's the right thing to do. So I have nothing further to say, but I'm happy to answer any questions any member of the committee might have.
Thank you, Bill. Representative Grunberg has a question.
These are kind of technical questions. First of all, and I know we have a lot of people on the line for these questions, and I don't know if I should wait till the end to ask, but I'd like to ask because I'm not sure who can answer them.
Representative Grunberg, if you would tell me what it is, and we can ask them right now, and now is the appropriate time.
Thank you very much. First, I don't know if this is for somebody in corrections or what. If somebody is incarcerated out of state, and sometimes this goes on for years, do they lose their in-state residence and their eligibility for a PFD?
Good question. Good question, and I, you know, we have people from the Department of Law, and we have Hillary online. Is there a response?
From anybody?
Silence.
I'll ask my next question, and we'll get these from somebody if I just put them on the record.
Just make a comment. It would seem to me that if somebody is convicted in Alaska and they're sent to an out-of-state facility, they were basically put out of state against their will. Nobody wanted
that, through the chair.
Representative Grunberg?
That may be true, but there's a specific statute that relates to eligibility for the PFD if you're out of state. And there are a number of things that are listed, and I do not recall being incarcerated out of state being on that list. And my question, and maybe we should ask this at some point, since it could take a little more work, Hillary, Martin, or somebody, to look at that, because we may need a conforming amendment to that statute.
Okay. And what's your other questions, then?
My other questions are probate questions. And first of all, if the person has been incarcerated and they are dismissed, I'm not sure how this could work, but my basic question is, somebody is incarcerated and then exonerated and then dies, will they, under this bill, be allowed their estate to claim the PFD And if so, are we going to need conforming amendments to Title 13?
Okay.
And third, in light of that, we may have people who are very old and not really able to go through all of the paperwork to claim a PFD. Do we need to make any conforming changes to the conservator statutes or have somebody appointed who can do this for somebody who can't handle it themselves?
Representative Groomberg, thank you for the questions. They're on the record. What we'll do is we'll leave those on the record for the sponsor to respond to is, you know,
thank you.
Acting chair, what I'll do is just say we're going to sit on the bill today and just give a chance for the responses, and I'm sure they heard the Department of Law, and also Hillary heard it, so we can get it back. And for the record, Representative Stutz has joined us. Representative Calrico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I to add to Representative Grunberg's vacation or questions, the only question I had about a vacation was I'm certainly not an attorney, but I know that if, for example, if a motion is filed within a court and there are multiple convictions, do we need to clarify in the bill that you need a complete vacation? But I just wouldn't want it to be a stumbling block,
sure.
You know, for anyone. If we have a vacation on one charge, but we don't on another, that would be a felony charge. Would we create a little bit of an issue here? And I'm certainly not a legal expert, but I'd like to
add those. Mr. Chair, we're kind of making a list, and we can add these to the running list and try to.
Right. Yeah, just for the record, Representative Lynn, you got the question okay.
Well,
get together with.
As I understand it, you're asking if they were vacated on one crime, but they were incarcerated for another separate crime.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it would seem to me that they might qualify for getting the PFD on one they're vacated for, but if they're in jail for another felony that they were in fact guilty of, they wouldn't get the PFD. Now, that's just my layman's off-the-cuff comment on that. The idea is somebody who seems to have been totally vacated and is just plain innocent, but if they vacate on the one, well, they might well be in jail for two or three different charges that are felony, then to my mind, they would not be eligible for the PFD. And some legal person can correct me if I'm wrong.
Representative Grunberg.
And I realize we're sort of putting the cart before the horse here, but since we're having kind of a list of questions, another one I would have, and this may be for Hillary Martin, whether we need to say on line 11 that doesn't apply until all appeals have been exhausted, because you could have somebody who's found not guilty, but then an appeal is taken, and the case is not finally disposed of. It's a more of a drafting question, whether we need specifically to put that in.
Okay. I think she wants to take
that. Go ahead. Identify yourself again for the record, please.
Deneen Tuck. Representative Keller, through the chair, I've been informed that most of these questions that are being asked can be answered by Jerry from the Permanent Fund Dividend Division.
Okay, thank you.
So if we could call him up here.
Okay, great. We'll do that. Jerry, if you'd come forward, and I hear that you have all the answers, that's good. Again, just if you before you
with me.
Yeah, before you identify yourself and go on the record, I have already stated on the record that we're going to hold the bill over.
Right.
So, you know, if you want to defer to the next meeting with your responses, don't, you know, it's your privilege. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue, and with me is Sarah Race, who's the Director of the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. And I heard a number of questions here that we could just give you answers to this morning, and that would, I think, speed up the process a little bit and maybe clarify it some. Like, for example, one of the questions that Representative Grunberg asked was, well, how much is this going to cost and how that works? And Sarah has that information here. And then some of the other questions about how we handle this, why the law is needed, it's specifically we can answer those questions. So,
okay.
if you'd like. In fact, I'll let Sarah speak to some of those.
So, through the chair, Representative Grutenberg, to answer your question about how much this is going to cost is, for the last 18 years, if we added up that total, we'd be right at about $27,159.28.
Per person. Through the chair.
Representative Grutenberg.
Ma'am, I'm not asking the administrative costs.
No.
I'm asking how much will be, do you anticipate will be distributed to prisoners?
That would, overall, or if an individual was let out of prison and they'd been in prison for 18 years, that would be the total that would be administered to that individual.
Paid to.
Through the chair.
Representative Grutenberg.
May I dialogue for a moment?
No, just if you would ask your questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not asking per prisoner. I mean, that is a maximum per prisoner. But what I'm really asking, Ms. Race, R-A-C-E, okay, Ms. Race, how much total will be coming, do you anticipate, out of the permanent fund itself? And that would probably involve some research with the Department of Corrections to see back to, however, I guess 18 years, and how many prisoners and how much, because there'll be varying amounts. That's helpful information per prisoner. But I'm trying to get the public information on how much total will be coming out of the fund.
So, Representative Grutenberg, just a clarification. You primarily historically, not necessarily projected into the future.
Yeah, I don't think we can do that very easily. If there were a way of doing that, but I don't want to get into idle speculation.
I just clarified your question. Thanks.
Yeah. So, through the chair, Representative Grutenberg, one area that we could somewhat relate it to is that we currently hold a reserve for accounts to pay out of the current year dividend for individuals that potentially turn 18 and their parents didn't apply for a dividend,
sure,
which again could be that same 18-year time span. And yearly, for last year's 2015 dividend, we held about $900,000 in a reserve account for the potential that individuals will come to us as they turn 18 and go to collect 18 years worth of funds. So that may be on the higher end of what we would be projecting, because
through the chair, Madam
Representative Grutenberg.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. You're going to have to take a look and maybe talking to the Department of Corrections or Department of Law, because they should be able to tell us how many individuals have been wrongly convicted. That should be something they have kept track of. And I don't think it's wise to assume that the number and amount for people who turned 18 has anything to do with the prisoners that are in this situation. I think it's going to require some looking at those.
Okay, and we can clarify that question. We'll respond to it as we go. Any other questions?
Okay, so there were other questions asked, but why do we need this bill?
Sure.
And again, this is Jerry Burnett. And we've talked about this. Currently, we have a regulation on the books that allows a person whose conviction was vacated to apply within 60 days afterwards and get their dividend. However, that is only for people who had previously applied for that dividend. There's two reasons that you're eligible for a dividend. You meet the residency requirements and you applied during the relevant period. These people who were in jail did not apply during that relevant period. And so this creates a situation for those people who didn't apply.
Gotcha.
See, some of these people who were vacated in the past, we've already paid dividends to. Mm-hmm. Because they had applied previously and met the regulations. So that's a further complication for that. And so, estimating the cost of this bill, again, it's complicated. Some of these people won't apply potentially could apply, and some of them will apply. Some of them have already applied and been paid. So But we need this bill for those people who didn't apply during the time, and it's perfectly reasonable for a person not to have applied during an 18-year period when they thought they were good. The other question that was asked was about people who were incarcerated out of state. The statutes currently provide that for people who are in the custody of the state, not incarcerated, but who are in the custody of the state outside, for example, children who are getting treatment for a mental illness, those types of people, those types of situations, or those people retain their eligibility. We see this as analogous to that. They're in the custody of the state, and they no longer will be denied the dividend because they were incarcerated. So from our look at this, it would not create a problem for those people. It's not exactly the same, but it is analogous, and the incarceration has been vacated so that is no longer a bar to paying the dividend.
Thank you, Jerry. And if you would respond to the last question before we go to Max for a follow-up. The conservatorship and senior, do we offer assistance?
Well, let Sarah respond to how we handle people who are incapacitated and people who have died during their eligibility period.
Through the chair, yes, we currently have an estate application, and so it does give the estate a certain period of time to be able to apply for dividends. So, again, we would run something that's very parallel to that, giving them the opportunity to be able, their families, to come back to us and go through the same process as far as determining the eligibility.
Representative Greenberg?
Thank you. My question was a little broader than that. I appreciate knowing what you said, but we're going to have a bunch of people who have a sort of a unique situation, at least to start off with. Most of these people are fairly unsophisticated legally. We're going to have to get them some legal help to do this, and it may involve having OPA or somebody, Alaska Legal Service or somebody, be able to effectuate this. Otherwise, you're going to have people who have been in jail a long time and are fairly disoriented and be given a few bucks when they get out and trying to find themselves and find some work. And if somebody's in jail, let us say they're in jail for 10 years and they've got an average permanent fund dividend of somewhere $1,000 or north of that. That's going to be somewhere $10,000, $15,000. And the one question that will come up are taxes. And people are going to be daunted anyway, and we're going to have to make sure that they can make use of this and that the taxes are going to have to be withheld and this sort of thing. And I'm not trying to make this difficult. I'm trying to make sure that we do the job, and it's going to take a little bit of collective thought to marshal the issues and figure out how this is going to work and whether the statutes are currently okay, and I hope there's no fiscal note, because there's going to be some cost involved in this too. And I'm just trying to think on how this is going to work. Otherwise, people are just going to throw up their hands and say, I can barely find the bus stop, let alone this. And anyway, I just want people to be thinking that this is, if we're going to do this, and I strongly support the bill, but, and the other thing, Mr. Burnett, through the chair, is in the custody of this state, I will want Ms. Martin or somebody legally to be really sure that that is intended to cover incarcerated people, because I could see a court or something coming down the pike and saying it doesn't cover it. Now, you're shaking your head. I hope you're right, but I don't want to be doing something that will backfire. Okay. We've done this occasionally.
Okay. Well, what we're going to do is, in light of time and two other bills, we're going to set this aside, but I want to make a comment first. The this is the year of the budget, right? And this is a perfect illustration of the responsibilities we have to just stay on this. I mean, this is a fundamental justice issue, you know, and this is something we can't, you know, we can't duck, and it's really important, and I really appreciate the sponsor for bringing it forward. Yeah. It's something that needs to be dealt with. I would like to suggest that, in my mind anyway, there's potentially a very huge issue here that is directly related to our budget issues, and that has to do with the uniqueness of Alaska. Alaska has the people's natural resources, and we monetize those natural resources, and then a portion of that goes into the general fund, becomes part of the normal spending process where there's a, you know, where we have lobbyists and debates and fights here in the legislature, and it gets spent that way. But 25% by the Constitution, actually more than that by the legislative choice of the past, has been put into a permanent fund. And the ownership of that permanent fund is a little bit different than the public common ownership of the other monetized natural resources. So when we start addressing an issue like this, we're really talking, you know, about the implications of the rights and the private ownership rights, which is fundamental U.S. Constitution, you know, rights to us. So it's a big issue, and the reason I'm pointing it out is the things we do here, because Alaska is so unique, we're defining the issue. You know, we're defining what this means, because there's no other state that has this common property monetized, dealing with it, you know, and we're just, you know, we're learning how to handle that. And, you know, as has been brought up in our current budget revenue questions that are on the table. So it's a big issue, and I appreciate the sponsor for bringing it forward. And with that, we're going
to set up. I'd like to just...
Maybe it was off the screen. I'm really sorry, but we have somebody else that called in to testify on the bill and in Anchorage. Theda Pittman, is it?
And if I can make before she does.
Hello?
Theda, if you would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
I'd be happy to. My name is Theda Pittman. I live in Anchorage, Alaska. Chairman Lynn and members of the committee, I'm happy to see you up on the step so early this morning. I'm an early riser myself. I want to raise a slightly different question, and it has to do with AS 1513, Alaska's campaign disclosure law. And I believe that statute should be sunsetted. I believe the budget of the commission should be zeroed out.
Theda, I don't mean to interrupt, but we this has to be a testimony specific to House Bill 243. Very interesting, and we want to hear from you, but we can't do it in this context. So, did you have testimony related directly to House Bill 243?
I don't have a problem with that. I support the Alaska Innocence Project, and there's a real possibility I won't get a PFD because I spent so much of last summer in Minnesota helping my Vietnam veteran, who's my nephew. So I'm not worried about whether I get my money.
Okay.
But I thank you.
Well, thank you, Theda, for calling in. I appreciate the fact that you're up early and paying attention. That's what makes this system work. So thank you. And with that, I'm going to Representative Lynn has a comment, and then we'll pass the gavel back to Representative Lynn.
Well, I'm only here 8 o'clock in the morning, because that's what time the committee meets. the budget, as we know, is at the top of the list of things we have to look at this session. Very, very important, obviously. But justice and fairness is even more important. We must be fair to all of our citizens, and that's what this bill is all about. Fairness and justice and equity, that's number one. And the budget is very closely behind that.
Thank you.
I want to thank you very much for working the bill this morning. I think there have been some very interesting questions raised here, very appropriate questions, and I'm glad we're holding this over. We'll work on it, and we'll bring it back as soon as we think we have some of the answers.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to take a little bit easier while I pass the gavel back.
State Affairs Committee will please come back to order. I'd like to thank the Vice Chair here for helping out with the previous bill. I think it was done very well, and we'll be working on it. We have a next bill to consider this morning, and I'd like to welcome Senator Michicki and his aide. Please introduce yourself and tell us about this bill and why you think it's a good one.
Thank you, Chair Lynn. Senator Peter Michicki, District O, and with me is my Chief of Staff, Chuck Kopp, who's also done a lot of work on this bill. So I walked into a voting, the place where I vote in Soldotna, Alaska, a couple of elections ago, and I noticed that one of the election pamphlets was open to a certain page. And I can tell you this, that there was an ad in that pamphlet, and it was an ad that was in favor of the guy that I was in favor of. But I was offended by the content of the ad. When you walk into the polling place with a state-sponsored brochure, you should not be guilty of electioneering. You simply couldn't have it open to that page and be in a polling place. I don't want to talk about who was in the ad. Doesn't matter. But it was in favor of my guy, and it offended me. So we started this bill to remove advertising from political parties in the publicly funded election pamphlet. I believe the pamphlet's intended to be a source of free, unbiased, in-depth information about current officials, candidates, initiative, judges, and legislation. The revenue generated to the state from this advertising is less than 1% of the cost of producing and mailing the documents. So there's not a financial hit to the state. In every election cycle, voters are bombarded with political mailings, flyers, radio, and television ads. I think the act of going in to vote is almost sort of a sacred right in our country, and I think that should be pure of political advertising in the polling place. So the other issue that we're bringing up, and the purpose of the CS before you today, is to improve access and integrity of our voter registration database and help prevent voter fraud. And as you work your respective districts, you see how inaccurate our voting rolls are in the state of Alaska. I mean, it's a very high proportion of the people in the rolls. The bill amendments will enable the Division of Elections to identify voters who have moved to another address in Alaska, voters who have moved to other states, voters who are no longer with us, and voters with duplicate registrations within our own state database. In addition, persons in Alaska who are not yet registered to vote could be identified, and we can provide them with the information on how to register. Current and past administrations have all commented on how badly Alaska needs a more accurate voter registration list. You've all seen the results. Each year, the division processes tens of thousands of question ballots after Election Day, a sure sign that our voter database accuracy is falling short. An accurate voter list is the bedrock of a smooth election. Chuck's going to talk a little bit about the changes, but what I will say is you have a letter from the past Lieutenant Governor, as for folks that may be listening, that's who manages elections in the state of Alaska, and we have the support of the current Lieutenant Governor, which is kind of a statement across party lines that we have a problem with our voter registration. I'll hand it off.
And if I may, I'm neglected to have somebody tell us what the CS is, because we need to adopt the CS, but would you do that for us, the difference between, so we can perhaps adopt the CS as a working document, since you're already up here.
Absolutely. I'm going to hand that off to Chuck, who's prepared to do that, and then we'll take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Chairman Lynn. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Michicki. The the purpose of the committee substitute that we ask for the blessing of the chair to speak from going forward is, like the Senator Machicki said, to improve access and database veracity to prevent voter fraud. It was brought to our attention during the interim that this is a real problem. Current and past administrations have said we have got to fix this issue, and one way is to allow the sharing of data with member states that would partner with a confidential services agreement where information shared is kept confidentially, but they can verify each other's voter registration base and save thousands of dollars.
No, is that in the CS?
Mm-hmm. I'm just talking about the purpose.
Are we going to adopt the CS? This is the difference that was added in.
That was the foundation for the CS that's before you today. What the CS does, I'll specifically speak to it. It amends 1557055E, and what that does is it permits the Division of Elections to match identifying information that's held by the division for any voter. If you see there in your copy, it amends out the language that speaks to facsimile registrations and other registrations. And the Elections Division said we need to make sure that we can match information for any voter, no matter how they register, against information for that same person held by the Department of Motor Vehicles and Department of Revenue in the Permanent Fund Division. The second thing the CS does is it permits the division to release the confidential information, which is kept confidential by statute, with special exceptions. And this adds the exception of allowing the division to share with states or organized group of states for the purpose of ensuring that the voter registration list is comprised of eligible persons and that they are eligible to vote in state elections. If that state or group of states that are in that partnership agree to protect the confidentiality of the information, the CS before you makes our law have the mechanics to permit that information sharing between states through a nonprofit entity who acts as the facilitator of that information exchange. That happened. That nonprofit is known as the Electronic Registration Information Center, and there are just over 20 states that are now partnering with us in this endeavor. And I have online Mr. David Becker, who can speak to both the founding effort to have states partner in this type of information. Pew Charitable Trust initially funded it. And then we also have a letter of support, of course, from Mr. Mead Treadwell. And we also have the Chief Executive Officer of ERIC Online.
Thank you very much. At this point, I would entertain a motion to adopt the CS, the working document.
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to do that for you. Could I ask one question, a clarifying question on that? So if I understood you right, the version W that's before us includes quite a bit that has not been vetted before in the building. So I'm just pointing out that the responsibility is heavy on this committee, on House State Affairs, to get it right, because it goes from here to the House floor. So, when you referenced Mead Treadwell's support, was he speaking of the CS, or was he speaking of the original version?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, former Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell had the CS, and we gave him all the supporting documents, and he drafted his letter based on what he saw we were doing.
Fantastic. Okay, and, so yes. I'd like to move that we use version LS0244W of Senate Bill 9 as our working document.
Okay.
Sorry,
just hold
on. I'd like to object for discussion only, please.
Okay.
It's a question, I guess, to Mr. Cobb. On the CS, lines 19 and 22, maybe elsewhere, they use the term state.
What?
On page 2.
What's the word?
S-T-A-T-E.
Okay, state.
State.
Got that.
Is that defined, or do you look to the general definition in Title 1? The reason I'm asking is because in some places the term state includes such things as Puerto Rico and Guam and things like District of Columbia that ought to be included in this, that may not be the term state normally. If you don't know, maybe we can find that out. I just want to be sure that we have everybody under the tent.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, internal consistency of the statute would indicate it's speaking about one of the states that we would, as a unit of government within the United States. I don't know if it would include those territories. We do have the Department of Law here that could comment further on that.
Maybe we can, through the chair, maybe we can get it from them.
Let's do that, but let's see about adopting the CIA. No, don't have a motion to adopt the CIA.
My objection's removed.
Okay, so we are on the working document. Now, I saw this election pamphlet myself, and I was offended basically by what I saw there. And I had entertained a thought of a somewhat similar bill myself. Because the election pamphlet, you know, it has all of us as candidates, or most of us candidates, put something in the election pamphlet, and it's basically a biography and our position, on various subjects, right? But we don't attack another candidate or anybody else in that. In this case, one of our major parties had a page in it I thought was, and it was my political party, by the way, that was I thought was a pretty vicious attack. I didn't think it was appropriate. The election pamphlet to me is about the candidate. Who are you going to vote for, maybe, right? We don't vote for or against a party. We vote for or against particular candidates and other issues. We don't vote for or against a party. So one party doesn't need to be attacking another party in that pamphlet, and I can see that escalating unless we do something about it, each one getting more outrageous as the years go on. So I applaud you on it, very much in favor of that. Let's ask Representative Price Tompkins.
Sure. And apologies, Chairlain, I didn't mean to derail your thoughts. I agree with them wholeheartedly, and it seems like it is a great bill, and I think sort of elevates the level of our civic discourse, hopefully. At least in the OEP, we can't legislate what goes on TV ads or anything like that. I also really appreciate the amendment and what that represents. I think that's just sort of common sense and positive. And I'd like to add, I especially appreciate the tailored nature of the amendment, specifically on page 2, lines 19 and 20, the additional clause for the purpose of ensuring the accuracy of states' voter registration lists, just so that this exception that's now granted in law is specific to this ERIC project that Pew is sponsoring. Just a question about the ERIC project. As more states join the ERIC project, what is sort of the upper ceiling? In other words, and perhaps this is for Mr. Lindbeck, eventually is there interoperability or intercompatibility with all 50 states' voter rolls? The underlying question, I guess, is that I've been told that some states manage voter rolls on a county-by-county basis, and so because of the way they store that voter roll data, may never be able to join ERIC. I guess I'm just curious how integrated all 50 states can become with this project.
Well, I'll turn that over to Chuck. I can tell you that conceptually, and certainly my encouragement to all 50 states is to convert their record keeping so that it fits in a nationwide database. And there are so many other benefits attached to that, from fishing and hunting licenses to voter rights. I certainly hope that's the way that they're going. But Chuck knows more about the actual technical function.
Through the chair, and for the record, this is Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Machicki. Representative Christ Tompkins, thank you. And so the 20 states that are partnered now have found that in partnering with ERIC, all the information that they send into this nonprofit entity, the information is anonymized, and then it is able to be cross-checked, de-encrypted, and then cross-checked by 20 states to know if you have a duplicate registration. And it is through this process that the information is shared perfectly, so they can have the veracity and the cross-checking. I do have the ERIC people online right now, and that would be really, because they can speak both to the security protocols, how the information is secured, and also how the states retain complete ownership of their information. They have complete control of it. And so it may look a little different in each state as far as what they're pushing into the system, because they do own complete control. But what ERIC does is it cross-tabs as many common variables as possible on the voter registration list.
Representative McKellar and then Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Chair Lynn. I shudder whenever we talk national databases, but that's just a personal problem I've got. I did note that the way it's worded, your amendment, looking at page 2, line 22, the condition is if the other state agrees to protect confidentiality. There's nothing there that says that we have to have a standard. In other words, if this information is released simply on the basis of another state's agreeing to be confidential, the meaning, as you know, of that can be quite nuanced and conflicted. And I understand that back up on line 8, that this is permissive, that the state may. So it's presumed that the state would have some standard. But did you consider putting in there some qualifier that gave the gave our state jurisdiction to set a standard, for example, of the confidentiality requirements that would be required before we'd release this information?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, the standard is the same for all member states, and I really think we should have the ERIC folks speak to this. Mr. David Becker is online, and one other gentleman, David Becker is with Pew Charitable Trust, and then another David, I forget his last name, with ERIC is there to speak to how that member agreement works. But it's a good question, but I do know that the states sign a common agreement so that the expectation is the same for all member states.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. My real question is whether or not we're giving away any of our responsibility ongoing here to be watching this. If everybody in the ERIC agrees to a standard, that's fine. But in our statute, what we've done is just made it permissive, and it's out of the legislative reach anyway. So,
Mr. Chairman, could you? I would request that Mr. Keller answer that question instead of sort of continuing to suggest it. I would really request that you have him answer that question. I think he can clarify the requirements for being a member of ERIC.
Well, just a clarification, if I could, Mr. Chair. You meant David Becker, get him on now?
Becker,
yeah.
Yes.
No.
Okay. Ms. Annie Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. My first as to the definition of state. I do not find a definition of state in Title 15. Therefore, I think we would look to the definition of state in Title 1. And the statute where they define state is ASO 110060, subsection A13. State means the state of Alaska unless applied to different parts of the United States. In the latter case, it includes the District of Columbia and the territories. And I want to focus on the last word. And this is a technical one, maybe for our alleged legal people. Sometimes when you look at a bill, you find something that is of interest in another statute, and this is a case like that. And my question is whether Puerto Rico is considered a territory. It may be a commonwealth, and that's something maybe we can ask alleged legal. It doesn't have anything directly to relate to this bill, but obviously, we would want to include, like, Puerto Rico in it. And I don't know if there's any other thing that applies to it. Yeah. Anyway, just I'm flagging that.
Virgin Island.
No, they're territories.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and the other question is, looking at the original bill, and the bill consists of several repealers, and those are listed here at the last part of the bill of the CS. But we have here the statutory language. It's in people's folders, and it's made easy, because what they've done is they have lined out the stuff that's repealed. And it sounds to me, and I gather from what people are saying, that one of the parties in the last election pamphlet did an attack ad on somebody or something. But the language here in the statutes, that the three statutes, that one says content of pamphlet, it just says a maximum of 2 pages of material submitted by each political party. And then the second thing, section 040, if the members would look at the second page, it says a political party may file a maximum of 2 pages of material. And all it says is you have to have a disclaimer that it's paid for. And my question is, these statutes have been on the books for quite a while, I believe. And I'm wondering if there is benefit to allowing the parties to have material in the election pamphlet and simply say you can't do an attack ad or something, and whether that would be constitutional. I don't know if the political parties would like to be able to do this. It sounds like everybody's been acting honorably until this one thing came about. And I'm wondering...
I'm going to get honorable involved in this conversation.
Okay.
I'm happy to take that question, Chairman Lynn, if you'd like me to answer that. I suppose we could complicate the issue. I don't understand why a political party has a place with candidates and specific issues in our election pamphlet, and I respectfully disagree with you, Representative Grunberg.
I'm just raising the question. You're the chair. I'm just simply raising the question, because if that was the only issue, that somebody had done an inappropriate act. But it sounds like the feeling of the sponsor is that parties don't have a place in the pamphlet. And that's fine as long as that's on the record, and that's what.
If I could make a point on that,
I'm not going to press it.
Everything in the election pamphlet is about whom to vote for or what to vote for. Vote for this candidate versus that candidate. Right? That's what it's all about. And maybe initiative or whatever else in there. But you don't vote for or against any political party. So why are they in there to begin with? It's inappropriate material, as far as I'm concerned, because, again, we don't vote for parties. We vote for people, and we vote for other things on the ballot, where we're not voting for or against a party. And I could tell you how I'd vote on some of that, but that's beside the point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I interrupted somebody who... go ahead, please.
Just a quick follow-up. What you're seeing is the elimination of all the aspects of the statutes that refer to parties in the brochure. That's why there's three places. But I'm not a particularly partisan individual. I assume when the ad came out, the other side said sort of, dang, I wish we would have thought of that. It's just a matter of time before it turns into a party war in the brochure, and I'm just trying to be preemptive in eliminating that potential.
And again, it's very difficult to draw the line. I know, you know, I've always put a statement when I'm running for office in an election pamphlet, but I know that I can't do an attack ad or, you know, it's all about me, not about my particular opponent. But this is over the line, I think. So the easiest way to do it is just to take it out. To trying to define what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. Any comment? Or would you want to? Do you have anybody want to call up here?
We have. They have online. Mr. Chair, if you want me to ask this, the Pew Charitable Trust talked to us about Eric, a guy by the name of David Becker, and the sponsors asked for his testimony, and he is called in for that. So
okay, Mr. Becker, are you there?
Hi, this is David Becker from Pew. Can you all hear me?
Yes, I can. Hear you very well. Thank you. Please identify yourself.
Excellent.
And give us your testimony.
Thank you. My name is David Becker. I lead Pew's elections team in this field, and we work to improve the efficiency, cost effectiveness, accuracy, integrity, and convenience of elections in the U.S. Thank you all for the opportunity to testify by phone today. I believe you have some written testimony that we've submitted. And we'd like to say how much we support our, the efforts to improve Alaska's voter registration rules by allowing Alaska to join a cross-state consortium like ERIC to improve the quality of its voter list. We have been working in this field for about a decade, and we speak with election officials across the political spectrum and all over the country about the biggest problems and challenges we can meet in the field of elections. And time and again when we have talked about this, the problem with the voter rolls has come up as a problem that all states are dealing with. Voter rolls are very difficult to keep up to date, primarily because of mobility and also deaths. People in America move a lot, and it's difficult for the election officials to keep up with that information. As a result of the work we've done, we helped build ERIC, which stands for the Electronic Registration Information Center. It's a 501c3 membership organization. CU does not own or control it. We handed it off immediately to the states that choose to join ERIC. The states that participate in ERIC, govern ERIC, pay for ERIC, and maintain ERIC in every way. The employees of ERIC report to the board of directors, which are made up of the states that comprise ERIC. What ERIC is a sophisticated data center run off software provided by IBM that allows the 15 states in D.C. that currently participate to get better information on whether a voter record is out of date because someone has moved or died. And I should say of these 15 states, these are red states and blue states, and they're all over the country, and they include states that are close to Alaska, like Washington and Oregon. So what ERIC does is when a state participates, they will send reports back to the state to let them know if there's information in their file that indicates the voter has newer information somewhere else. In other words, they might have had gotten a driver's license in another state, they might have died, they might have submitted a change of address with the Postal Service. And then the state can begin the process consistent with federal and state law to begin to update their records. To date, in the states that comprise ERIC has helped those states identify about 3 million voters who moved from the address in their official voter file, and also helped the states identify over 140,000 voters who had died since they last voted. One also important thing to note about ERIC saves the states that choose to participate a lot of money. There's a small fee to participate, but states have found that they've saved well more than those ERIC costs, since they no longer have to pay for inefficient list maintenance, and they see significant reductions in things like returned mail and questioned ballots because they have better addresses in their system, and that saves a lot of costs. So just one of the questions that came up earlier, and it was a very good question, it's our goal at Pew that all states eventually join ERIC, that this is one of those things that ERIC has been around for about 3.5 years now, and we've now got about a third of the states who have joined. But due to federal requirement under the Help America Vote Act that all states have a statewide voter registration database, and that requirement's been in effect since 2005, there's no state that we know of that couldn't join today if they chose to do so, and we're working with many of those states to get more states on board. We expect more states will be joining in advance of the 2016 election so that they can make sure their voter rolls are as accurate and have as much integrity as possible. And then after that election, we'll continue to work to try to document ERIC's benefits and encourage states to join. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Testify. Representative Tallarico.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, but I'd like to be excused from the rest of the meeting. I have a prior commitment. But I would like to just state for the record that I do appreciate the sponsor bringing this forward. I'm very supportive of this effort and the current version that we have. But due to a prior commitment, I
have. So you have to leave now?
I do.
Okay. You are excused, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr.
So far.
Chairman. We appreciate that.
Any other comments you'd like to make? Do we have anybody else testifying?
Yes. But did you, could I ask a question? Could I ask a question,
yes.
Mr. Chair? David, this probably, you made this point, and I just, I was distracted there for a bit, but this, the state of Alaska, for example, is free to join ERIC any time. That's an administrative decision that would be made by our Division of Elections. Am I right or wrong?
Well, one thing I am not is an expert on Alaska state law, so I don't know if there's anything in Alaska law that might require legislation in order to allow Alaska to join ERIC, consistent with the membership agreement, as was mentioned, that's signed by all parties. I certainly defer to all of the experts on that point. But we are working with many, many states to encourage them to join ERIC. Some states have used legislation, some have not.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's great, and I just want to point out that we have John Lynn back online that wants to testify, and he's from ERIC, and he may want to respond to that, and he has testimony for it. So.
Fine.
Mr. Chairman, we're also prepared to respond to that.
Senator, would you like to respond first, and then we go to our guest online?
I would, and actually, my understanding is that legislation is required just to, and we have the Department of Law here. They're going to speak to a very small conceptual amendment that gets the wording right. It's about the data sharing with other states through a nonprofit. So
the legislation is necessary.
The legislation is necessary in order to share with ERIC.
Okay, who's the next one? We have this new iPad here. Huh? Who's going to testify and who's not? And it'd be wonderful if I could read it.
So. For the benefit of the chair, is John Lindbeck from ERIC State in Oregon. Do you have testimony? Identify yourself, if you would, for the record, and proceed.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for inviting me to testify this morning. I'm John Lindbeck. I'm the Executive Director of the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC. I'm not going to repeat the information that David just gave you or that was presented by the sponsor, but I can give you a brief status report on ERIC. I'll just list off the states that are currently members. Alaska's neighbors of Washington and Oregon are joined by the other western states of Utah, Colorado, and Nevada. In the middle of the country, we have Minnesota, Illinois, and Louisiana. And in the eastern part of the country, our members include Alabama, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Virginia, Delaware, Maryland, and the District of Columbia. When states submit their data to us and we provide reports back to them, it enables our member states to act on information in accordance with federal and state laws. And our members reach out to voters who have moved to request that they update their voter registrations or provide permission to cancel their registrations in their former state. Acting on that data also protects our states from opportunities for voter fraud. In addition, our members reach out to the unregistered with information on how to register. Based on the experience of other states that have joined ERIC previous to Alaska, we are now able to provide projections to Alaska based on the experience of the current members in ERIC of what the initial reports to Alaska would show. And those initial reports are always the largest ones because you're going all the way back in time. And then the subsequent reports are smaller. But those initial reports, according to our projections, would show would help identify for the Division of Elections about 38,000 voters who have moved within the state of Alaska and failed to update their registrations. And about 8,200 voters who have moved out of Alaska, but their voter registrations are still on the Alaska rolls. We expect that we would be able to identify about 1,600 deceased individuals on the Alaska voter registration list based on the experience we've had with other ERIC states, and that we would be able to identify about 900 individuals with duplicate registrations on the Alaska voter list. In addition, we'd be able to identify about 195,000 Alaskans who are not yet registered to vote. The benefits to Alaska of ERIC membership are potentially huge and could result in considerable cost savings. One example, Alaska in the 2014 state elections issued almost 28,000 question ballots, a situation that, as you know, extends the count well after Election Day, and the vast majority of those ballots cannot be counted in full. The processing for question ballots takes days, and close races are held in suspense for unreasonable lengths of time. A more accurate voter list means that substantial numbers of those voters would cast a regular ballot on Election Day because they would be updating their registration sooner rather than later. the processing time after the election for dealing with question ballots would be substantially reduced. So I just wanted to provide that as one example of a benefit of joining here. So thanks for your time, and I'm happy to answer any specific questions you may have about Eric and its operations. I'm here to help you understand how we work and what we do and how the states cooperate with each other. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Resident Keller, I believe, has a question.
Superficial probably, but if there were a security breach and something was hacked or whatever, I would assume the Eric then would carry the responsibility and liability?
If there is a security breach of Eric data, the Eric membership agreement includes provisions that if Eric is at fault for a breach or responsible for a breach, Eric indemnifies the members for any costs associated with that breach. So the answer is yes.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions to testify? If not, I'd like to call Joanne Blackburn. Are you online or in the room?
Yes. Good morning. I am Joanne Blackburn, and I'd like to say that I believe in the constitutional right of economic association, and I appreciate Alaska's autonomy as a relatively new state. There is power in that. I dislike participating in organizations that are against everything I believe in. It is antithetical to all that I believe in to place my personal information in an organization such as ERIC. I distrust Megadata, and I would like to not participate. And I don't appreciate individuals from different parts of the state that intend to co-opt my thinking so as to cause my information to be available to the one percenters, to strangers to me, and I don't think it's good public policy, and I would appreciate it if you would take into consideration that there are opposite views, and I recognize that our division does a very good job of and take pride in their work, and I do know that they watch World Obituaries and that sort of thing, so I really don't think that this is a huge problem in Alaska. We have half the state's population living in Anchorage, and there's no reason why Alaska should co-opt me and make me participate in an organization that I am completely antithetical to, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to let you know.
I appreciate your testimony, and you're speaking for yourself, correct?
Yes, I am speaking as a member of the public, and I would like to say that I have a positive viewpoint of the way we currently arrange things here in Alaska, and I think this is extraneous, and I don't appreciate fees to organizations that stand for things I don't believe in. I don't like contributing to Megadata against my will, my expressed will. So as our representative, I want to thank you for letting me and others who have a similar viewpoint to myself, and there are many that maybe are at work today. And so I would appreciate it if you would put this on the back burner. Thanks very much.
Thank you for your testimony. That's why we have these hearings, so we hear all points of view. That's, you know, we learn a lot. Representative Keller, did you have a comment, a question, or you'd be wanting to do some kind of an amendment?
Right. I want to say, first of all, thank you for your testimony.
Yes.
It was heard. We did, you know, and everybody here was listening, and thank you for your time. We have a version W in front of us, and I have an amendment that I'd like to propose at the request of the sponsor.
Would you make the amendment, please?
I move amendment number one. It's labeled, you all have it in front of you, as LS0244/W1.
Okay, you move the amendment. Any objection for discussion?
Mr. Chair, I object for discussion only.
Okay. Reverend Keller, will you describe the amendment, please?
I would be happy to, but it's at the request of the sponsor, so I will defer to the sponsor.
Good. Senator? or?
Chairman Lynn, thank you. For the record, Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Mushiki, Department of Law, is here to explain the amendment, which more adequately permits the data sharing that we are requesting, and also the House concurrent resolution due to the title change that's occurring in the House with this bill. So Libby is here. Come on up, Libby.
That person come up, please. Thank you very much, and good morning. Please identify yourself and comment on the amendment.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Libby Baklar. I'm here from the Department of Law at the request of the sponsors to explain the CS, the recent amendment, the most recent version that Vice Chair Keller referenced is a cross-reference to the Department of Motor Vehicles data, which is required to be shared via elections. The reason that Mr. Becker and Mr. Lindbeck mentioned other states require legislation for this project is because of the way ERIC is organized as a 501c3, and only states are members, but nonetheless, there is not currently existing statutory authority for us to participate in a 501c3 without this cross-reference. So one of the things that ERIC requires is DMV data via the Division of Elections, and what this most recent amendment does is amend a small tweak to Title 28 just to make explicitly clear that we do have authority to share the data that we get from DMV, rather the data that Elections gets from DMV, and share that with the participating states under the ERIC project.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the wording on line 5, it says under the section are declared confidential and private. By whom would they be declared confidential and private in this language?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, that is referenced to the Department of Administration, Division of Motor Vehicles. I think that's the declaration stated in records to be kept by the department, as in the Department of Administration. That's a small tweak to Title 28, and in that statute, department means Department of Administration. So I assume that declaration goes to the legislature declared that, but it's in the custody. That data is in the custody of the Department of Administration, Division of Motor Vehicles.
Yeah. Thank you. Because my concern as I read this again is that in the bill itself, it says the qualifier is whether the other state agrees to keep it confidential. And so I'm just pointing out for the sponsor, for consideration here, do we really, is that the intent here? Because I see this as leaving the legislature completely out of it as far as setting the standard for the confidentiality. In other words, it just presumes that it's going to happen, and maybe that's appropriate. I just don't know the law good enough to ask the question, but, I'm nervous, so.
Respectfully, Representative Keller, through the chair, I think that is a question better posed to Mr. Lindbeck or Mr. Becker, who can speak to the security of that data. I know that, a number of states have joined the ERIC project, as was previously testified. And again, the only reason we need the Department of Law concluded in 2011, actually, that we need a statutory amendment to do this is because of the structure of the organization under which the states are resting.
Right, Chair Keller?
Yeah, and both John and David assured us, of the security of ERIC and the sponsor. And I'm not calling it into question. I'm just saying my question is, do we really want to leave it there? I mean, in other words, what happens in the future? What happens in 10 years? It just seems like we should make sure we have a dog in a fight here.
Mr. Cohn.
Through the chair, Vice Chair Keller, that is a good question. But one of the things that Mr. Lindbeck and Becker stated that I think helps alleviate is the board of directors are all the member states. And so any time when there's a confidentiality concern, maybe how that process is working or held, the states have complete control, and each state sits as a member of that board of directors.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up. Yeah, that's precisely my concern. Because the membership into ERIC would not be the policy-making body. It would be the executive branch of the state of Alaska with this action. So that, just for your consideration, you know. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. What I'm going to do, if I may, we've got some questions here, and we got an amendment before us, and I think I'm going to hold this bill until next meeting. We have some unanswered questions, and if you would like, we can vote on the amendment perhaps at the next meeting, or we can do it today if you choose. What's your pleasure,
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, to me, just administrative, I would say let's vote and get it in here so we have it in front of us. That's it.
Okay. Who objected to the amendment? Somebody withdraw the objection?
Nobody objected.
Okay. Nobody objected?
No.
Okay. Without objection, amendment number one passes. And we are going to hold the bill. And I can assure you that we'll try to get it heard as quickly as possible, because we have so much on the agenda this session. We want to get some of these, non-revenue, non-budget bills out of the way as quickly as possible. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for I think, Mr. Kopp or maybe Ms. Bacalar. Is the ERIC framework, is that considered a compact? I don't believe it is, but I just was curious.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I don't know that it's a compact. I'd have to look at the statutory definition of compact. I think it's just an agreement as many agencies in the state enter into. I don't know that it's technically a compact. Maybe Mr. Kopp knows.
I think ERIC is better suited to answer that. I think Libby is right. Yeah. There is a strict statutory definition for what is an interstate compact, which we have for arrest warrants sharing, how we transport in-custody persons or family law.
Chair, so you do not believe it is a compact?
I don't believe it is.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chairman, if I may, just one point that Representative Keller brought up. It's the same folks that are assuring the confidentiality now of our data would continue to share, to be in charge of that confidentiality in the future. It is the Division of Elections, which has always been in charge, and it's the elections directors of the states that oversee this. So we're not changing anything administratively that's already in the law.
Thank you. Okay. Senator, did you have a comment?
Just to add to that, in fact, none of the departments in the state that share information outside of the borders of this state are controlled by elected officials. They were all administrative, whether it's law enforcement or the courts or others. Unfortunately, I'd love to have that level of control, but we don't have it anywhere in our process. And I just a final comment. I don't know how you want us to close out, but folks may have an idea of the integrity of our voter rolls. I don't know, I'm not going to ask each of you to raise your hand how closely you are tied to the constituents in your district. If you are and you spend any time in your voter rolls, you know that's simply untrue. The inaccuracies are very difficult for the department, and this will assist in that effort. And when you find very close family friends that have passed sometimes more than a decade in the past that are still on the rolls, it's you realize that it's a tough job. They do the best they can. This will help them, and will save the state a lot of money and the integrity.
Yes, and we do want to keep rolls as accurate as possible.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to hold this bill now. What I'm going to do is I'm ask Representative Price Tompkins to at least introduce his bill today, so when you schedule it again, it'll be a bill previously heard. So, would you do that, please?
Yep. Hey, Bob. Do you want to adopt this version then so he can talk to it?
Oh, yeah. Would you, there is a CS on this, I believe. Would you quickly tell us what the CS is?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Chairman Lin, the CS primarily modifies the cost that was in the original bill from $150 to $35 for the specialty license plate.
Okay, thank you very much. Do I have a motion to adopt the CS?
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt 0999/echo of CS for House Bill 217 to make it the working copy.
Okay. Would you quickly introduce the bill, and you will have an opportunity at the next hearing to reintroduce the bill, so just so we know basically what we're dealing with here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Jonathan Grice-Tompkins, representing rural Southeast Alaska. This bill is basically American Idol meets Alaska license plates, and every 4 years, Alaska State Council on the Arts would hold a statewide competition for designing basically a license plate that sort of best embodies the spirit or the beauty or the landscape of Alaska. You could have artists from Byron Birdsall to Ray Troll to anyone in between submitting their best designs. Those designs would be adjudicated by a jury that the State Council of the Arts assembles, and then after finalists are selected, Alaskans at large get a vote for the winning design, and that winning design goes on a limited edition run for 4 years that Alaskans can choose to buy when they get their license plate, and then the process repeats itself.
There's nothing on a license plate is going to be about Juno in the rain, is there?
But, Chair Lin, I think that would be a great license plate submission for the State Council.
Okay. Thank you for introducing the bill, Representative Keller.
All right. If I could, I think we adopted the version Echo as a working copy, and I would, I don't know how we do this. Do we rescind that because the actual version that we have in front of us is version N, November?
Well, we just rescind the adoption and then make a new motion.
We
so do I have a motion to rescind?
Mr. Chair?
So yeah. Move.
I'm going to object for discussion.
Yeah, well, one subject at a time, but go ahead.
I only have the Echo. I don't have November.
Nancy just gave you the new one.
Oh, she did. Oh, I apologize. Yeah, I removed my objection.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I hear a motion to rescind it, whatever the adoption.
We rescind it. Now,
I'll make another motion, please.
I would like to make another motion that we adopt CS version N is in November of 217 is a working document. And I apologize, I did not have it in front of
me. Well, no problem. But I didn't catch it either.
Okay.
So thank you very much. We'll be anxious to look at this, and we'll get it on the agenda as soon as possible, as we will the previous two bills. Is there anything else to come before the committee at this time? If not, I'd like to thank everybody for their participation, and we are...